call later.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks.
You're allowed.
Well, <folks. laughs>
I'm still here, though.
Y'all good.
Okay, well, I guess we're being recorded now, so we better begin. We'll start with the prayer on the top there, so we say that three times. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of giving the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of giving the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. I go for refuge until enlightenment to the Buddha, the teaching, and the spiritual community. By the merit of giving the teachings, may I achieve Buddhahood in order to help all living beings. So, we're on chapter 5. Moving ahead here. I think we did one verse last time.
That verse.
So hopefully.
Josh?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt, but I'm wondering if there's anything we can do. Amy's thing looks like it's just turning and turning. I don't know.
I am here.
You're there.
I couldn't figure out how to IM you back. Sorry.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad you're there. Thank you.
I guess it's just your video is not coming in, but your presence is there. Yeah, it's chapter 5. Let me find the page.
Did you get my email?
What's that?
Did Amy get my email?
Amy, you got Diana's email, I hope.
No, I didn't check my email yet this morning.
Check. Okay.
Sorry.
Check it.
She wants you to check it.
Okay.
Yeah, we're on page 134. Right at the very bottom of page 134. At least that's my printing has. Does it say those who trust at the very bottom of 134? Okay. I have a slightly different version here, which I felt I could mark up. Make all my notations. So, we're starting on the second verse of this chapter. And right at the bottom of the page there, it says, those who trust the Buddha will gain freedom from all fears, even the fear of death. So, it's interesting, this word trust. In the Tibetan Buddhist way, it's not just that you're having faith or trust, that you're trying to have that separate from your knowledge. So it's really trust is based on knowledge, and knowledge is based on studying and studying the teachings, reflecting on the teachings, meditating on the teachings, putting them into practice, and only then do you is there really a sense of trust in the teacher, or just sort of, it's not just because the Buddha said, I am the enlightened one. This is what you're doing, is you're taking his teachings and you're trying to, critically analyze them and determine that they are, in fact, that the Buddha is in fact, telling the truth. And so then for us to trust, it really requires that kind of critical analysis. And it's in this country we have this word skepticism. It's not really skepticism is not what you're trying to adopt. You're trying to adopt keep an open mind. Okay, keep a los surinema. The ideal student is the. This is in chapter 12 that we were studying this summer, but the ideal student is what did we do? Is even-minded, nonpartisan. I think that's maybe the best way. You can't approach the teachings and say, oh, I believe, you know, the Buddha and everything the Buddha says is correct and everybody else is incorrect. You have to keep an open mind that analyzes every teaching, every position on knowledge, really, and try to come up with your own understanding of whether that's correct or not. It's really the ideal student has that kind of open-minded inquiry into all forms of knowledge, and then, once you've subjected everything to your own critical analysis, only then do you accept, oh, this is true, and the Buddha is a reliable teacher. So then, and then you have to have the other qualities, or you have to have be intelligent, be able to discriminate what is correct and what is incorrect, and also have an interest in the teachings. You know, you can't be like. I love that one image. You can't be like putting grass before a dog, right? I mean, dogs like to have a bone. They like to have meat. But if you threw them a bunch of grass, they would just turn away like that. You have to have it's like putting meat before a dog, you know, have a real strong interest. So, just as ordinary people are terrified by the words Lord of Death, so the words Omniscient One terrify the Lord of Death. We should probably say something about Lord of Death. It's sometimes... it sounds like we're talking about somebody who's a person of the Lord of Death, a being, but it's an analogy. Death has dominion over us all, okay? Therefore, Lord of Death. There's nobody who doesn't die. So then, Lord of Death. But then when they talk about it, they talk about it like it's an actual person. You know, so. Yeah, the Grim Reaper, the same idea. He's going to get you in the end. That's fine. Couldn't see Daddy back there. So, here the commentary. This is a... The verse was written by Aryadeva, who was the, for those of you who knew or new to this book, and the commentary was later written by a Tibetan scholar. But there's a Aryadeva, I guess, wrote it, and I'm not quite sure what century Aryadeva was. Sorry to say. Maybe 4th century, something like that. And Her commentary was later written in, let's see, 15th century, is that what it is? Yeah, 15th century. So then, well, is he just writing his own idea, his own interpretation of what Aryadeva says? No. There's a whole commentarial tradition. He's just reflecting that commentarial tradition from the time of Aryadeva all the way down to... Sorry, were you playing basketball? And
a little slower.
Toward Jen.
Oh, no.
I just had some minor surgeries.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry, just
keeps the pins in place.
Keeps the pins in place. I'm going to throw up now.
So we're on page 135, Jim. We just got started, really. And so then the commentator, Gyaltsepche, is really saying, is compiling a lot of different commentaries and writing a commentary that is also maybe more contemporary for Tibetan people, but presenting it in a more contemporary way, you could say. But it's still based on all this explanation from the time of Aryadeva down to the writing of the commentary. So the top of the page of 135 there, the commentary. The words Lord of Death terrify ordinary people. Similarly, just hearing the words Omniscient One endow whoever hears them with the good fortune to attain nirvana, thereby terrifying and subjugating death as well. So you see, death becomes sort of personified, but it's still the idea of Lord of Death is, as I was saying earlier, Jim, that means he has dominion over everyone. Everyone's subject to death. But when the Lord of Death hears the word Omniscient One, then the death is subjugated. Why? Because the Omniscient One teaches the way, meaning the Buddha, teaches the way to liberation. And liberation is frees you from death, frees you from the grip of death. You're liberated from having to die and be reborn. And so then that terrifies death. We can say, sort of going back and forth between this personification and actual death, right? Sutra says, those who hear my name will attain nirvana in any of the three vehicles. Here the footnote explains the three vehicles. The Buddha had three different kinds of disciples. Well, three disciples, we can say, three types of disciples. The one is, I guess Lou didn't make it, huh? Okay.
Yeah,
he was here this morning. Usually he stays here. So then, the three vehicles are for each of these disciples. He taught certain teachings for each type of disciple. So then, you end up with three vehicles that way. There's the Shravaka. We usually keep the Sanskrit for these because everybody knows the word Bodhisattva. Okay, Bodhisattva is one of the three disciples. That's a very commonly understood word, but nobody knows these other ones, which are Shravaka and Pratyeka Buddha. But they're not talked about so much in Tibetan teachings because the Tibetan teachings are really Bodhisattva teachings. They're oriented towards developing the attitude of a Bodhisattva and becoming a Bodhisattva. They're the Mahayana teachings or the Mahayana vehicle, the Bodhisattva vehicle is what they really are. And they're not, although they incorporate the vehicle of the Shravaka and the vehicle of the Pratyeka Buddha, they don't emphasize liberation for one's own sake. They emphasize attaining enlightenment in order to liberate all beings from their suffering. And so that's the vehicle of the Bodhisattva. Now, when we're using the word omniscient one, omniscience, often it's, what does the Buddha know? Why is the Buddha called the omniscient one? In what sense does the Buddha have omniscience, knowing all, right? All knowing, gunkien, knowledge of all. One commentator, Denda Larama, explains that omniscience means that you know everything necessary in order to help others attain enlightenment. You know everything that needs to be known to help others to become enlightened. And so then, so that sort of means that a lot, actually. I mean, you can think of that a Buddha has to know many things. And this knowledge is acquired over a long period of time, and therefore a Buddha's in a career as a bodhisattva, learns many different things and becomes very, accustomed to many different kinds of knowledge, so that when he or she becomes perfectly enlightened, then that knowledge is brought to its perfection. Okay, all of that knowledge is brought to its perfection through constantly learning, through acquiring knowledge over a long period of time. So therefore, Buddhists acquire knowledge, and we have to study. We have to acquire knowledge all the time, and in our lifetime, in the short lifetime we have, and to become a Buddha, you have to acquire it over many lifetimes, and it's like in Tibet, like when Geshe Yeshe Thapke was studying in Tibet, there was such a focus on just knowledge, learning, acquiring knowledge for the sake of acquiring knowledge. That's the way the religion was observed, was practiced. And when he came to India, it wasn't until he was in India that he got this idea that it was something else. Like somebody said to him, his son, I guess this was when Genla was staying in Ladakh, this man's son was studying at a college where Genla was teaching. And the man's son then asked him, well, what is he going to do with the knowledge that he acquires in this school? What kind of job, what kind of work can he get? And Genla had never actually heard that. Nobody had ever asked him such a question. And the thought had never got to him. He didn't know quite what to say, because he'd only thought of knowledge as being acquired for the sake of, knowledge. He never thought of it as being something that you needed to acquire in order to get an income. He said it was quite a shock. Talk about culture, what do you call it? What do they call it?
Culture shock.
Culture shock, I guess that's the idea. Coming out of Tibet, right? It was a very different orientation towards knowledge. Anyway, so, but that's, as Buddhists, we're acquiring knowledge over many lifetimes in order to bring knowledge to perfection. And so you have to, for instance, a Buddha we're talking about Buddhas in these first three verses. So then a Buddha has to know, when studying reason, studying logic, has to know many different types of reasons that establish various objects of knowledge, like, for instance, the emptiness or the dependent arising of all existence. Then he has to learn many different, or he or she, you can think of the Buddha over many lifetimes being a he or a she. So then during those many lifetimes, acquiring many different forms, understanding many different kinds of reason. Why? Because there's so many different types of beings. Okay, everybody has different thoughts, different dispositions, different, ways of looking at things. And so you have to know many different types of reasons in order to be able to teach them. And that's what a Buddha does over a period of three immeasurable aeons, is usually the way it's expressed, and three immeasurable aeons and many lifetimes over that period of time. One aeon is 10 to the 50th power of years. So I don't know. It's a long time. It gives you a feeling, though, for what perfection is. Okay, a Buddha is bringing knowledge to perfection over a long period of time. So a Buddha is somebody who's extinguished all faults and acquired or attained all knowledge. Okay, so then, it's not done just by some kind of instant experience that opens up the world to him, to the Buddha. It's something acquired over a long period of time. So then we as Buddhists, right, who are trying to become Buddhas, trying to reach perfection ourselves, then we have to look at things in a very long, from a very long-term perspective, really. And so then, the view that Genla is expressing, that it's just knowledge for knowledge's sake, it's not really to, acquire certain knowledge for, so that you can get a job, right? It's really, it puts that whole, that whole idea in, and, it makes it more immediate that it's that we have to constantly be studying and acquiring knowledge. But a Buddha's mind is also, I was going to read something here about the Buddha's knowledge that usually you have this understanding of reality, okay, that is reached through doing much analysis and study and using logic and also reflecting and then meditating. It takes a long time to reach a clear understanding of what we call of an understanding of reality or emptiness, or you can call it dependent arising, if you will. Dependent arising is another way of thinking of it. And this reality of dependent arising or emptiness, you don't have a direct experience of it until you reach what's a bodhisattva on the bodhisattva path understands it in direct experience on the path of seeing. We call it the path of seeing. There's five different paths, and the bodhisattva begins on the path of the career of the Bodhisattva begins on the path of accumulation, and then the path of preparation. And then the path of seeing is the third path. And so the path of preparation is in preparing you to see, you know, to have that direct experience of emptiness. And then you have the path, after the path of seeing, you have the path of meditation, and the path of no more learning, no more to learn, means you become a Buddha. And so it's on the path of seeing you have this experience of emptiness. It's where you've been analyzing whether things exist or don't exist, that they exist the way they appear or they don't exist the way they appear, and you're trying to fashion a understanding of emptiness that goes between the two extremes of that things exist the way they appear. They seem to have some kind of existence, independent existence. They don't need to depend on something else. Therefore, the idea of dependent arising, that they in fact are, they do need something else to depend to for their existence, to depend upon for their existence. And but they appear to not have any need for anything else for their existence, and so that's called independent existence, or it's the extreme of things existing in their own right, or existing inherently or intrinsically. That we consider, you know, as one extreme. And it's an over-reification of the way things exist. And then the other extreme is that things don't exist at all, okay? And so when you're analyzing, you're trying to keep between those two extremes and finding a middle way. And so then when a bodhisattva's analyzing and in meditation and having this direct experience of emptiness, which is means that things lack this way that they appear to exist, that they lack this independent existence. Emptiness means a lack, right? And so it's a lack of that inherent existence. And when you have that experience in meditation, where you're, it's said that the mind and experience are like pure water poured into pure water. There's like an experience there, a direct experience of emptiness. And then when the and this, that's all there is in that experience. Nothing else appears to you at all in that experience. There's just emptiness. An emptiness of any kind of intrinsic existence. The reason being is that if you're analyzing, is there any intrinsic existence to things, and you're not finding emptiness means a not finding. You're not finding any intrinsic existence, and then you have this direct experience of that not finding. And so, if you found something, if there was something there, then there wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't be experiencing emptiness. You'd be experiencing inherent existence. But you never do. And so there's nothing appears in that experience. And then, so that's when you're meditating on that. You're just meditating on that one thing. Then when you come out of the experience of meditating on emptiness, then things appear as they usually do. They seem to always have their independent existence to them. And so then that's said to be like a reflection, you know. Like a reflection in a mirror seems to be like a real face, right? I mean, the face moves And you could, you know, a real body, if you have your whole body in this mirror, like we have back there, you know, it would look, it looks sort of like a real person, right? Because it can move and have mouth moves and everything. But it's not a real person. And that's the idea, is that everything appears like a reflection, right? That there's, it's a, you know, you're seeing it, it looks real, but it's false, right? You're understanding that it's false. That bodhisattva and that coming out of that meditation sees things as appearing, sees the falsity of things. It's said to be like a magician's illusions. You're just sort of seeing things, but you're like the magician. You're not fooled at all anymore by these appearances of a certain of an intrinsic, you know, independent existence. It just you can walk. You can just walk through it without being, you know, you don't think of yourself as independently, you don't think of others as independently existent, you don't think of objects as independently existent, and your actions as independently existent. Nothing appears as independently existent. But everything is, you understand everything as a dependent arising, that they're all, you understand that they're all our dependent existence, that they depend on other things for the existence. Either they depend on their on causes, right, and conditions, or they depend upon terms and concepts. Just to, you know, they're dependent upon our own mind, right? Everything is dependent upon our own mind. So then there's this kind of bifurcation, really, that you never are aware. You never directly perceiving emptiness at the time that you're, out of meditation, out of your direct meditation experience, and so that false appearance of conventional reality, we say, is always with you while you're acting and while you're doing compassionate deeds and helping others. Now, the reason I'm explaining this is because a Buddha doesn't have that. It only ends when you become a Buddha. A Buddha simultaneously sees conventional existence and ultimate existence, which would be the emptiness of things. So then, the Buddha's knowledge is very unique. That's the only time that you have those two simultaneously. So it says, it expresses it here, without obstruction, the Buddha's knowledge contacts the real nature and diversity of all phenomena as if they were a datri fruit placed in the palm of his hand. It's a little, often we think we should translate that as olive, so somebody would know, an error has occurred.
Which book was that?
Is everybody back? Anybody back? No. What was that?
We're here. I just can't see you.
I can hear you. Can't see you.
Oh.
Name.
Oh, okay. So you're... Yeah. Natalie, you're there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it said that for some reason, video was suddenly unavailable.
Oh, let me click it on again. I must have...
No, you're not alone. Everybody has suddenly lost video. For some reason, it's just become unavailable.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so we're going to have to just do it, you know, as a, you know, what is this called? A group call.
Audio.
Yeah. We switched over to audio.
We pay.
Then.
Could you read that again? What page? What volume?
Page, volume 1, page 183. So without obstruction, the Buddha's knowledge contacts the real nature, that means the ultimate nature, okay, ultimate truth, and the diversity of all phenomena. Diversity of all phenomena means their conventional existence, as if they were a datri fruit placed in the palm of his hand, or as if they were an olive placed in the palm. an error has occurred. Okay. I'm getting the same message that there's some error occurred and we don't have the video available. So then it goes on to say, thus the sage's knowledge comprehends all phenomena, whereas others' limited knowledge cannot comprehend the vast objects that are to be known. So once you have that kind of knowledge, that is omniscient. So then there's some verses of praise here written by somebody who, I think the praise and honor of one worthy of honor is written by somebody who, there are these, a few compositions by people who converted from Hinduism, I suppose it was in those days, and to Buddhism. And so he says, only your sublime wisdom comprehends all objects of knowledge. For everyone other than you, there are objects yet to be known. I like that. There are objects yet to be known. For you, there's nothing left to be known. Then,
is that on the same page?
What's that? That's on the same page, yeah. Then he goes on to praise again. O Bhagavan, meaning the Buddha, the entire origination of all types of phenomena throughout time is within the range of your mind, like an ambalan fruit in the palm of your hand. Ambalan, in this one, instead of a datri fruit, it's still the size of an olive. And then this is all types of phenomena throughout time. A Buddha knows past, present, and future, like we're seeing this table. Buddha has direct knowledge of everything. So then, how is that so? Remember, we were sort of agonizing over, well, how can Buddha see into the future, right? And then we were sort of surmising, well, he must do it this way or that way. You don't have to go there. The Buddha has eliminated all ignorance. Ignorance is what keeps us, you know, veils knowledge from us. Buddha knows all. So then Buddha knows all directly, as if, just like we can know the chair or the computer or whatever right in front of us. Like the wind moving across the sky, your mind is unimpeded with respect to the single and the manifold, animate and inanimate phenomena. There's nothing that a Buddha's mind doesn't know. A friend of mine translates, instead of saying sentient being, he says limited being. Because we're all limited in our knowledge, right? Our knowledge is limited. A Buddha's knowledge is limitless, unlimited. But then when you talk about the Buddha's knowledge, then the Buddha's mind, then you have to, when that's one part of the Buddha's mind, and then the other part of the Buddha's mind is the compassion, right? The caring for others. And so then, in the same way that beings are bound inescapably by the affliction, okay, the afflictions are like our ignorance and our hostility and our attachment and our pride and all these kinds of, and then various ignorance being not knowing, right? And there's various wrong ways of knowing as well. That we're inescapably bound by those. We're just always bound by our afflictions. And so in the same way that living beings are bound inescapably by afflictions, so is the sage bound by great compassion, which thus arises continuously as he beholds the suffering of living beings. It's just, he's constantly bound by great compassion for all. leaving none out. So the same praise says, the afflictions bind all these beings without exception. You, in order to release them from the afflictions, are eternally bound by compassion. You're always bound by compassion. We're always subject to our afflictions. We're bound by them. A Buddha is bound by his compassion, his or her compassion. Should I first make obeisance to you or to the great compassion that causes you to dwell for so long in cyclic existence despite knowing its faults? That's a very eloquent, you know, praise of the Buddha. The praise in 150 verses, that one. Oh, that's a slightly different one. This other one is praise in honor of the one worthy of honor. So there's some other verses there. They're all very good verses. If you look at that, it's the same page. So wisdom and compassion, the Buddha's wisdom and compassion, comprise the Buddha's mind. Then, back to the commentary here. Omniscience. I wanted to say something about omniscience. So, this idea of the Lord of Death being terrified upon hearing the words of the Omniscient One is like the following analogy. When a son was born to a certain king, he issued a decree freeing all prisoners. He was very happy, presumably. His subjects were happy, except for the prison guards, who were as frightened as if they had been exposed to a contagious disease. Similarly, when Tathagatas, that means Buddhas, come, all beings except demons are happy. Apparently, when Buddhas are about to become enlightened, is anybody getting cold sometimes? What did you set it at? I think you have to put it at 68, right? Then it drops too much for. What is it at now?
It's 60, almost 67.
Oh, that's not too bad. It's just the other thing about heating is that you become sensitive to the low thing. It's no longer hot. You know, it's cold, but it's still quite warm. But your body feels cold instantly. That's why.
You also need to get fresh air because you can't heat dead air.
No.
Old time saying you can't heat dead air.
Is that what they say?
You need to get some fresh air into the building to. Because otherwise, once it gets heated up, you can't heat it up anymore.
I haven't heard that one. Well, that's probably better for you anyway, I believe that.
We have enough leaks in here.
You're probably all right.
So when a Buddha is, when the Bodhisattva is trying, is, you know, making effort to become a Buddha, then there's beings that are very unhappy. And, you know,
the bad guys.
Yeah, the bad guys get very happy, unhappy. One time when we had all the geishas assembled, our teacher, Bhakti, asked them, do you think that there's any being that is totally bad, you know, just totally evil, and the mind immediately sort of picks up on these guys, you know, these mean guys, the demons. Well, no, there's nobody who's never done anything good in some part of their many lifetimes. I mean, we've had a beginningless number of lifetimes, and besides, the mind, all the afflictions and so forth that motivate us to do these harmful actions or destructive actions, the afflictions then are just superficial. The nature of the mind is actually good. You know, that there's no the fundamental nature of the mind is pure. It's not that afflictions are not ingrained in the nature of the mind. And we can all appreciate this, but like the Buddha said, you have to critically analyze it. This is another thing that you have to critically analyze. Is it true or not? And so one evidence of that, and one easy evidence of that, is that if it was ingrained, then we would always be angry, right? Because it changes, then it shows how the mind is, how these afflictions are not ingrained in our nature, okay? And they're just sort of appearing and then disappearing. But there are many. That's one area of study. In Buddhism, there's many areas of study. You can sort of think of Buddhism as being, as Holiness likes to say, a science of the mind, a religion. There's different facets or parts of it. And also a philosophy. So then you can study these different areas. And studying the science of the mind, then you understand how it is that the mind can be considered pure, okay? But everything has to be subject to reason and analysis. So I like that, her, all the beings are happy except the demons, right? The bad guys. I guess that they lose their power, right? That's you have to think that they're interested in controlling and having their own, what do you say, their own wishes fulfilled, right? So if they lose their power around a Buddha, then that makes them unhappy. So the next verse. Surely he lacked omniscience, since he did not answer 14 questions, such as whether the self and the world are permanent or impermanent, and so forth. Rather than disproving, it establishes his omniscience. A subduer has perception of that which should and should not be done or said. What reason is there to say that the omniscient one is not all-knowing? Or you could say, that's not a good reason to say that the omniscient one is not all-knowing. Once you know everything, then you know what to say and what not to say. I'm just sort of wondering what this word for perception is there. Yeah, this idea of directly perceives is in the commentary. The commentary talks about what kind of perception we're talking about here. It's direct perception. Like I was saying, like we see the chair or the computer or whatever in front of us, then the Buddha directly perceives the right and wrong time for his temporary and ultimate actions. The Buddha doesn't have to think, okay, like we do, about what should I do, what shouldn't I do. The Buddha just acts spontaneously out of this direct knowledge of everything. So a Buddha knows what is the right and wrong time, the appropriate time, what action should not be done, what is not beneficial, what is harmful, as well as all that should or should not be said. All of these are just directly available for a Buddha. Just like our knowledge of that's a table is directly available for us. Nobody asked to question whether that's a table, right? Or the chair that we're sitting on. Since the Buddha possessed such perception, he did not give an answer to these questions, which were based on a belief in the true existence of persons and phenomena. This one, I think he's talking about particular, when 14 questions say whether the self and the world are permanent or impermanent. Okay. So then the question is said to be based on the belief in the true existence of persons and phenomena, of this inherent existence or true existence or intrinsic existence. And so then it says here, it is not feasible for a basis of attribution whose existence has been negated to have an attribute. So then, if you're asking questions about something that you perceive as truly existent, right, and saying, it's saying, then why would he answer you? It's sort of like, yeah, what can you say? Are the horns of the rabbit, right? The rabbit doesn't have horns, right? Are the horns of the rabbit permanent or impermanent, or are they beautiful or not? You know, I mean, it's just like, it's a totally irrelevant question because there aren't any horns on a rabbit, right? So that's the idea. It's something that totally does not exist. Why, you know, can't have attributes, right? And that's what, there is no such thing as something that inherently exists or intrinsically exists. I mean, there is a computer before me. There's no question about that. But there's no inherently existent computer before me. Or truly existent. A computer seems to exist in and of itself. It seems to have some kind of an independent existence. But it's clear that it's a dependent arising, depending on many different things. All the different components in there are all working together to make it work. And it's very dependent upon the electricity from the battery. If you pull out the battery, you pull out the cord, you know, nothing works. And so it's a very dependent, what's that?
Then it's just a box,
a metal box, you know. So I mean, it's a dependent arising. It's not it doesn't somehow exist in its of itself. But if you look for what is the computer there, you know, if you analyze and if you subject it to critical analysis or ultimate analysis and look for what is the computer, is the computer there, you know, then you can't come up with anything. No, the computer either has to be the same as its parts or different from its parts. The easiest way to analyze it is for us beginners is that. Things are either self-identical or they're diverse. There's no other choice. So when we say computer, we think that there's something there. You know, we think there's something there that is the computer that would be findable. And if we such that when we looked and searched, we'd say, here it is. You know, okay. So if we search among the parts, if we say the computer is the parts, okay, it's the same as the parts, we can say if the computer is the parts, then if you take, you know, once it is the parts, if you take away the things that aren't the computer, then the computer should become more clearer. It should be more clearly there, right? You take away the things that aren't the computer. And so, you know, is the top the computer? Is the are the sides of the computer. You know, all the different parts is the keyboard, the computer is a laptop, so it has a keyboard right inside it. And this is the screen, the computer, that's not the computer. And there's nothing, the more you look for the computer, the less clear it becomes. If it's there, it should start to become clearer. And when you look for something and you clear away the things that aren't it, it should become clearer, right? Just so like an image in the mirror that's a dirty mirror. If you're trying to see yourself in the mirror, you clear the things away that aren't the image, right? And then you go, oh, there I am, you know, there's the reflection. But that doesn't happen when you analyze, when you look for, you know, something that seems to be clearly there to us. And so then you can't find it the same as its parts, and you can't find it different from its parts. If it exists differently from its parts, then it should be able to find it separate from the parts, because if it exists in and of itself, on its own, then it has to be findable separate from the parts. It can't depend upon the parts. It can't depend upon anything. So it would have to be like a pot and a cloth, as an example, right? When you see a cloth, you think that's a cloth. When you see a pot, you think that's a pot, right? You don't have to depend upon the pot to think cloth, right? In the same way, this should be a computer that's separate from the parts, right? What do you say? You can distinguish it as being the computer, right? Without having the parts there. But that can't be done either, okay? You cannot find a computer separate from the parts, completely different from the parts, not dependent upon the parts. So if something's neither the same as or different from its parts, then it can't exist at all. So you decide it doesn't exist at all. You have to come up with a decision that it's not findable at all, but it appears to exist in its own right, and that's like a reflection. And it operates as a dependent arising, you know, and that's enough for it to exist. It exists. It has a dependent existence. So then this is what we were talking about last week. Then that's the middle way between the two extremes, is that it doesn't exist in and of itself, right? It doesn't have its own independent existence, but it does have a dependent existence. You can't find anything that is it, you know, ultimately, when you subject it to that kind of analysis. But if you don't subject it to an analysis and just, you know, assert it as without any kind of ultimate analysis, then it has an existence. It has a conventional existence. It has a dependent existence. It's a dependent, and because it doesn't have a dependent existence, it can't have any independent existence. So it lacks any kind of independent existence.
Would independent existence also imply a permanence, a fixed nature?
Does independent, you have to say it again for the benefit.
I lost it. It went out and it's gone.
Does independent existence. You have to put it right up.
Does independent existence imply permanence, something that is not changing?
Independent existence, yes, it does. Yeah, because something that's subject to cause and effect, right? The way you can understand something is causal, okay, is because it does change. So something that's...
I'm just thinking that an easier analysis would be that...
I can't. It's not working there. You got to...
It says it's on. I'm just thinking that an easier analysis would be, does it change or not? And if it changes, it doesn't truly exist.
Yeah, yeah. That works except for things that don't change. There's some things that don't change.
What things don't change?
What exactly is change? What's that?
What exactly is change? Like, think about change. Like, going from one...
What exactly is change? Like, from going to one thing to another, you're still the same thing, essentially, but...
Essentially?
Essentially, yeah. Down to the core.
See, that's the problem we have.
What? Essentially?
Yeah, there's no essentially existent thing. No, we're talking also about essentially existential existence. Okay? That when you analyze and look for the essential nature of things, you can't find it. Everything lacks an essential nature. You can't... All you come up with is a non-finding of the essential nature. And therefore, the essential nature, everything lacks an essential nature. There's no essential nature to things. Well, essential nature is this idea of the horns of a rabbit. You know, it's something that's never existed and never could exist. If things had essential natures, then they could never interact with other things. Nothing, you couldn't have change in that case. Nothing would ever change. But there are permanent things that don't change. Like they call it uncompounded space, for instance, the lack of obstructive contact. That's always going to be there, unchanging, you know.
So doesn't that exist?
It does exist.
Okay.
It exists. It's a permanent thing.
Okay.
It's a permanent. There are permanent and impermanent things. So, just analyzing on the basis of whether they're. So it doesn't work as a good analysis for emptiness, mm-hmm. But you know, it's not just another way of saying emptiness by saying. Impermanent, you know. They come similar, but it's basically impermanence with intrinsic nature or essential nature. We think of something very static that's always there, unchanging, like Spencer was saying. And so that's why thinking about impermanence loosens up our fixed idea of essential nature. Okay, seeing that things don't stay the same from one moment to the next, that they're in a constant, that there's a Buddhist idea of momentariness, that things constantly are produced and abide and then are destroyed and reform all in one instant. They're never stationary. Never staying for an instant. They're in a constant process of change. And so that gets you a little idea, you know, that loosens up this fixed idea. I mean, fixed is another way of thinking about, you know, essential nature, some kind of fixed nature to things. There isn't a fixed nature to things. Although that's the way things appear, you know. I mean, what do we want to call it? Amplifier, a wireless amplifier, as it says on the outside. It doesn't seem like a different wireless amplifier than, you know, since we've been sitting here, but... In fact, it's been changing every moment. And at the same time, it's been disintegrating. It's what do you say? Losing its existence.
Like us.
What's that?
Like us.
Like us.
Like us.
We're the same, yeah.
Constant dismiss into old age.
Yeah, yeah.
Sickness.
We're constantly, the minute we're born. He can know, though. Yeah, we know. You get when you get older, then you really.
Otherwise, you're just growing.
But growing means aging, actually. You know, from the very moment you're conceived, the next moment you're disintegrating.
Yeah, but we're actually disintegrating before we're not.
I'm looking for your. I'm looking for your clock, Diana. Where's? Oh, it's behind. Okay.
Isn't this one?
Yeah, this one works.
Did you want to stop this?
Yeah, you're growing before
us. Diana, do we need to change the?
Do we need? Okay.
Okay.
I know I should.
Oh, anyway, we're.
I digress.
Back to the text here. So it's not feasible for a basis of attribution whose existence has been negated to have an attribute. So to talk about essential existence, essential nature, why would you can't talk about something that's not existent right from the beginning? He did not answer because he saw that they would not be receptive vessels for the profound, were he to teach selflessness. If he answered either any way, he couldn't change, you know, he couldn't reach them. Thus, there is no reason to say that the omniscient one is not all-knowing. Indeed, this substantiates his omniscience, because he knew exactly what should be done, right? Asked whether it had an end, the conqueror was silent, because he did not give this profound teaching to worldly beings who were not receptive vessels. The all-knowing one is therefore known as omniscient by the wise. So then there's this analogy here. A certain king, wanting to penalize a rich Brahmin, told him that he would be punished unless he quickly sent his family's well. I love this one. It took me a while to figure this one out. I read this. What? Wait a sec. It is well. It looks like it should be a misprint or something.
Yeah, right.
You know, but he really has it in for this rich Brahmin. You know, he wants to give him something that's basically impossible to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Send me your well. Okay, I'm the boss. You got to send me your well. And so then the Brahmin's daughter replied, "Wealth attracts wealth, and one elephant attracts another. Please send us a well." In this way, they avoided punishment, because the king couldn't send a well either, right? So she one-upped him, you know. I love that.
She was saying, in effect, she was saying, "You first."
Yeah, you first. Okay, and so then that shut him up. Similarly, a Buddha acts for the welfare of sentient beings by skillful means. A Buddha says things and does things that are going to be, you know, effective, right, for that person. And right? So, question, if Buddha does not say what should not be said, did he not say, referring to Devadatta, "What of this boy who wears one piece of cloth and has taken the bait?" Huh? Yeah, this is 11. You have to go to footnote 11. I see. Wears one piece of cloth and has taken the bait. Here it says, the Buddha prescribed that monks should wear robes made of small pieces of cloth stitched together. So one piece of cloth would be not the right cloth, right? Mm-hmm. This was intended to counter attachment to clothing. The Buddha's cousin, Devadatta, who failed to recognize his extraordinary qualities, habitually did the opposite of what the Buddha recommended to express his dissent. he was, he was always...
So he was a teenager.
Yeah, right. He was always giving the Buddha a hard time, and he was always trying to one-up him and do all these different things. He's actually a very, very well-versed scholar as well.
He was no slouch.
He was very close to the Buddha in knowledge. I mean, he was a very knowledgeable person, in fact. But he never recognized that the Buddha had anything over him. You know, he never respected the Buddha. And he was always doing things to try and harm the Buddha. So the bait refers to Devadatta's ill deeds, such as causing schism in the spiritual community, which would bring him suffering in the future. So the Buddha was always responding with compassion. So although he said this, it was not to harm others, but to turn them away from ill deeds. You see, the person is saying, well, isn't that a nasty thing to say? You know, that's basically what he's saying. If the Buddha knows what should not be said, then why did he say such a nasty thing? That's what the guy's saying. Well, he said, although he said this, it was not to harm others, but to turn them away from ill deeds. He saw that unless he deflated Devadatta, many transmigrators would be harmed. So words intended to benefit, even if unpleasant, are entirely virtuous. So he's saying something that's unpleasant. It might be emotionally unpleasant, or unpleasant to hear, but it's keeping others from following in the footsteps of Devadatta, which would or people others meaning his own followers. You have to be able to distinguish what's right and what's wrong, and you're actually, he says this later on, the reason that they're followers is because they don't know how to distinguish what is right and what is wrong, and they're depending on the Buddha to help them do that. So anyway, any questions then on that?
Josh, something came into mind that there's a woman who died in the last 3 weeks
or
so.
Oh, you want to?
I turned it off because it was causing feedback on that.
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you. There's a woman named Lynn Margolis who was a great scientist, I think from MIT, but she just passed away, and it brought up in her obituary that about 20 years ago she postulated a new theory of evolution and called symbiogenesis. And up until that time, and even now, some people still believe that the evolution is driven, like variations of species is driven by random mutations in cell division, or DNA duplicates DNA, except for sometimes there are random mutations, and then the environment chooses which of these mutations will be helpful and which are selected against.
Yeah.
And so it seems odd anyway, but her postulation was revolutionary. Now most people accept it, that the symbiogenesis means that DNA does not change randomly, that there's some interfacing, there's interaction and influence from the environment causes DNA as it reproduces itself to make minor changes.
Oh.
And so it took a long time for people, the scientific community, to come around. But I think when I'm reading this, I think that Buddha would say it doesn't make any sense if you're talking about like ecology. That's a system of dependent arisings. That any phenomenon should be independent. And if something is random, you just dismiss it as random. Then you're really saying, it has no other cause. It just caused itself, right?
Yeah.
And so it's, I'm making this connection now that what Lynn Margolis was saying came from evidence, but it's funny how we don't question a premise sometimes that is completely illogical, even to the game and the rules of modern the science of ecology, that of all phenomena being part of dependent arisings. How could you have something that you would be satisfied calling random?
Yeah, right.
And to Kathy's point, then you're saying that just changed itself. or, you know, or doesn't change at all.
Yeah, right. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, His Holiness often questions this idea of random. You know, he just says, when he talks to the scientists, he just sort of brings it up. Random? Don't you think you should examine that
seriously?
One?
Seriously?
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, he doesn't tell him no, you know.
I'm
going to
steal that from him. Yeah. <to a scientist.
laughs> So anyway, going on to our next verse. I think we have time for the next verse. Mind should be understood as paramount or foremost in all activities of the three doors. Three doors here means physical, verbal, or mental activity. It just means your body, speech, or mind. They call them the Go Sum in Tibetan, so it's a literal translation would say three doors, but usually we're trying to avoid it because you always have to like footnote three doors, you know.
Yeah.
Three doors. Without intention, actions like going are not seen to have merit and so forth. In all actions, therefore, the mind should be understood as paramount. This is because actions like coming and going are not seen to be meritorious or demeritorious except through the power of the virtuous or non-virtuous intention motivating them. So just walking down the stairs after class is not, you know, in itself either a constructive action or a destructive action. But if you're doing it with intention, if you have a certain intention when you do it, then that can make it, if you're running down to, you know, help somebody get in the door who's stuck, and it's a helpful action, right? I mean, a certain intention, right, makes it virtuous or non-virtuous, we say usually, but constructive or destructive. It is like the following analogy. I like this one too. A naked ascetic entered a temple and prostrated to one statue while touching the other one with his posterior, thereby creating virtue as well as an ill deed. It's a great one, but, you know, she goes into, there's all sorts of debates over, does this illustrate is this a good illustration or not? But I think that the idea is that, you know, for me, it's like the person was intentionally doing both, right? He was just sort of like, oh, I can do both at once, you know? You know, and so he had the intention of touching his butt to one statue and touching his head to the other one, you know. It wasn't like he accidentally, you know, touched his butt to one. You know?
I think you'd know that.
So he did one of the difficult things to do. Right? Mm. Then. Should we go on to the next verse, maybe? That one is sort of straightforward. So the next verse, in bodhisattvas, through their intention, all actions, virtuous and non-virtuous, become perfect virtue because they are in control of their minds. Well, actually, with these 104 and 105, we've sort of changed, in the outline, we've changed topics where we're... Now we're explaining how to practice the bodhisattva deeds, the cause of becoming a Buddha, and the special features of the motivation for training in these deeds. One is showing mind as the principle of the three doors. Then now we're showing how even that which is non-virtuous in others becomes supremely virtuous in bodhisattvas by the power of their attitude, the overriding power of their attitude. And this is what I was talking about previously, that bodhisattvas have this altruistic attitude. And So, in bodhisattvas, through their intention, all actions, virtuous and non-virtuous, become perfect virtue because they are in control of their minds. Since mind is foremost in all activities, virtuous actions, such as giving and even such actions as killing, which in others would be non-virtuous, all become perfect virtue in bodhisattvas who are in control of their minds because of their motivation to help others. They just always have, they have a constant thought to be of help to others, whether it's during a virtuous action or a non-virtuous action. The non-virtuous usually has to do with the physical actions of the bodhisattva. There are some, and also some verbal actions, like lying, you know, with an intent to be helpful to others, you know. So and then there's this idea of killing with an intention to be of help to others. This is because they have gained the ability at will to engage in virtue and not to engage in non-virtue. So they, cutting off a finger bitten by a snake stops the momentum of such greater suffering and causes only a little pain. This does not make the doctors who do it non-virtuous. Bodhisattva deeds are like this. They're doing what might appear to be painful in the short run to spare somebody harm in the long run. And so there's this analogy of a bodhisattva called Mahakaruna, who was a captain. This is a former, during the former, one of the former lives of the Buddha. He was, this bodhisattva was of the same continuum as the Buddha, the same mental continuum is the way we say it, who was a captain. Used a short spear to slay a pirate captain who intended to kill a group of 500 bodhisattvas on board. He thereby turned his back on 100,000 aeons of cyclic existence. It means that he attained great virtue from doing that. And the idea is that he knew this one person was plotting this. What do they call massacre, right? Mm-hmm. One person was going to massacre 500 other bodhisattvas. They're already bodhisattvas, so massacring a bodhisattva is worse than massacring, I mean, it's an ordinary person. And so he was going to create a great cause for much suffering in the future. So then he it's just like this idea of the snake, right? Cutting off the, if your finger is bitten by a poisonous snake, cutting off the finger is going to save your life, right? And so then he's sparing him much suffering in the future. And he's only thinking of him in that context. And then it's said that he did it with the intention also to help the other bodhisattvas. And certainly also, although killing, it doesn't mean that killing doesn't have any effect, right? I mean, he didn't like totally negate the effect of killing. It said that he took a rebirth in a hell realm for having killed this person. But it was like a ball, you know, a bouncing ball. He just went into the hell realm and then back out. It was just a very short, you know, very minor effect of this because this can only be done by bodhisattvas that are on the eighth stage, that they have this pure compassion that time without any selfish intent. So then
so who's the he in the last sentence? Is it the captain or is it the bodhisattva?
The captain, yeah.
Okay.
It's not that the pirate captain, sense. I don't think.
I
think, yeah, he thereby turned his back.
So the pirate turned his back on 100,000 aeons of cyclic resistance?
No, I think that the virtue that's acquired by the bodhisattva captain, right, avoided, you know, the effect of, it's still the subject of the previous sentence was the bodhisattva, so it's saying he thereby, that means by doing that, he turned his back on 100,000 aeons of cyclic existence. If it said something like 100,000 aeons of hell, you know, then maybe it would be the pirate captain. But I think it's talking about that
he got Buddhahood that much quicker.
Yeah, he got Buddhahood that much quicker.
Okay. Yeah. Well, when it says turned his back, that means you lost something to me.
Yeah, right, he didn't have to stay in cyclic.
Yeah, he lost. He didn't have to be reborn into cyclic existence. He shortened his.
Okay, I get it. Okay. No, I'm sorry. A little slow on the update.
He shortened his stay in the in the cyclic existence. He became a Buddha that much quicker.
You turn your back isn't usually used as progressive.
Yeah, that's what confused me, because turn your back is usually something bad happens.
Yeah, and the Baden way, it's just like, you know.
Josh didn't translate this.
But anyway, they use this word, come back. So anyway, we're approaching 3 o'clock here. Maybe it's a good place to stop here. It's also a change in the outlined topics. So then we're starting the merit of generating the altruistic intention. We're talking about the attitude of the bodhisattvas after that. But it's a... It's also talking about a bodhisattva on the first ground. We were talking about the first level, or first, what did I call them levels. And then people also call them grounds. The path of seeing, when you attain the path of seeing. But if anybody had any questions, I'm trusting that everybody still exists out there on Skype. Is everybody there on Skype? You don't move, so I don't know.
Here.
Yeah, you're
here.
Okay. You're still there. Okay. Good.
Hey, Josh, could I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
This goes back to the verse about the demons, you know, not being pleased when Buddhas get Buddhahood or...
Yeah.
How would the Tibetans describe, or like that our lamas describe, are those demons affecting ordinary people in our daily lives? Like, what kind of beings are they, and where are they? Or do they just show up, like, at certain times when high bodhisattvas are around? Or what are these demons?
Yeah, they're called... They're really called Lai Bu. Yeah, Lai Bu. There's different types.
I mean, there's somebody typing. Can everybody mute?
Oh yeah. then the demons is they're certain class of deity, really. They're gods or goddesses, but they seem to appear more when you have somebody who's very good, for instance, and then they try to do something to thwart that, bother them.
Bakshi.
Like Bakshi, when Bakshi was staying here, he would be woken up in the middle of the night by these
ugly
demons. They'd be like sitting on the end of his bed, you know, and he'd say, "Oh, he's so ugly," you know. basically they'd knock against him when he was sleeping and do, you know, just sort of bothering him. They didn't seem to be, you know, inflicting any harm more than that. They're just sort of like, I guess we say poltergeists are like that, right? Aren't they just sort of mischievous or something? There's a belief in and poltergeist, and then using the word poltergeist is maybe for that one, right? Mm-hmm. But these other ones can be much more destructive, like the ones, you know, at the time of the Buddha when they were trying to shoot arrows at him and so forth, when he was in a meditation on love and all the arrows turned to flowers, mm-hmm. you know, when he was in that meditation. But they are a class of deity, of a god or goddesses. Then it seems mostly that they don't involve themselves when somebody is not really becoming doing good, right?
Why bother? Sort of like messing it up themselves.
Yeah, right. They seem to be taking care of them. You know, they don't have to work, and they don't have to thwart this person because they're doing, they're doing their work. You know, because they're always just doing harm and so forth, and so what? They don't really care, right? They're not getting anywhere. But once they start getting somewhere, then or doing something, right? And then, then they try to thwart the person. Like Milarepa had constant problems meditating in the caves, that there'd be these demons that would bother him. I mean, it can be quite a bother when you're in meditation, and it's not like he could be drawn out of his meditation, but they just sort of bother him. Yeah, right. You know, if you read some of his stories, and so they seem to be, well, there's, what is it in the
it's kind of like children in the back seat while you're driving, and you're still driving, but they're still annoying.
Yeah, right. They're kind of annoying, right? That's right, Spencer. But there's four kinds of demons. Usually, the word is du in Tibetan, and then there's du shi. There's four demons, and there's the demon of but the other ones, it's more, metaphorical. The demon of death, the demon of the aggregates of a body and mind, the demon Chiwedu, Pumbedu, and why am I forgetting that other one? What is it?
The son of man,
that's the one I was leaving. That's the one that's actually these demons, these ones of the, yeah, the son of God, actually. It's Thai Bu. Thai Bu. And then, not a capital G. It's just saying, you know, Thai Bu, the child of a god or whatever. And then, Nyumungidu.
The
afflictions is the fourth one. Yeah. So there's the demon of the afflictions, the demon of death, the demon of the aggregates. Once you have the aggregates, then you have suffering. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. So, and the afflictions, of course, we've been talking about how they give trouble, and death. Death robs you of the chance of improving yourself. It's a big problem, you know. I mean, you have to change your life, you know. You have to take on a new life, and it's very uncertain. So death is a big problem, too. But then there's this fourth one called Lai Bu, the son of a deity or whatever, however you want to translate that. Usually people use the Devaputra, they use the Sanskrit, so it's not mistaken with, and there is this expression, son of God, referring to, in the Christian country, to Christ, right? Yeah, so you don't want to get that, it doesn't carry that meaning at all. But anyway, that's these, you know, demons who are a divine class of beings. So, any other questions? Okay.
Thank you, Josh.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Before we go, Sue, we always...
Thank you so much, Josh.
Okay, you're welcome. Glad you could come, even though you're not on video. they robbed us of video. I don't know why. Okay. On the last two verses, the bottom two verses. I dedicate all this virtue to emulate the knowledge of the hero Manjushri and likewise Samanda Bhadra as well. With whatever dedication is praised as supreme by all the conquerors who traverse the three times, I also dedicate all my roots of virtue for the sake of auspicious need.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Fred. Good of you to
thank
come.
You for class.
You're welcome. I'm glad that everybody could come.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, sir. So, I guess that Anne is. Are you going to talk to anybody?